renewables are the cheapest form of energy ever known to humankind.
The more renewables you have in the system, the lower energy prices will be. Getting more renewables into the system, because they are the cheapest form of energy, more renewable energy means energy prices are lower than they otherwise would be. Renewable energy is by many lengths of the straight, the cheapest form of energy. The key is getting more renewable energy on at a much faster rate. Our transition in Australia has been too slow and too disorderly. Our policies are all designed to make it faster, and that's why we're so committed to getting to 82% renewables by 2030.
Welcome to the Baseload Podcast. My name is Ben Beattie. The opening clip was Chris Bowen in October 2022, interviewed on the 7:30 report by Sarah Ferguson, telling us about how cheap renewables will make our electricity system. Now, if anybody's been paying attention, that's not quite the case. And there's a few reasons for that, and we're going to go through some of them today. More recently, Chris Bowen appeared on a podcast with a guy called Dan Illick, some kind of activist, comedian, I don't know, partly paid by the ABC, partly funded by Climate 200 back in the day, apparently. Anyway, I'm not going to dig into too much of that, except some of Chris Bowen's comments on this particular podcast are well worth paying attention to, not because they make any sense, but because it indicates how deeply flawed his thinking and ideology has become.
I want this transition to be so locked in that a change of government can't stop it.
We'll also compare Energy Minister Chris Bowen with energy economist Danny Price of Frontier Economics. He was on ABC Radio, interviewed by Steve Austin, and he had some very interesting words to say about our current energy policy.
We're told constantly that, you know, renewables are the cheapest form of generation. It's a monstrous lie.
After all that good stuff, we'll get into the GOAT. The GOAT, of course, will have to take on Chris Bowen, but there's a smattering of the renewal comedy galahs in there as well. And to wrap up the episode, the interview is with me. A friend of mine, Mark Ostwald, here in Queensland, interviews me about electricity and generators and transmission and all the good stuff. There's a little bit of technical things in there. Hopefully I get it all right. If I get something wrong, let me know. TheBaseloadPodcast@gmail.com. All right, on with the show. This episode, I would like to introduce two of the big problems in the electricity system caused by our current energy policies. I call these problems disappearing middle and missing money. We'll start with disappearing middle, and this is about generator bids, bid stack, and merit order. First, a quick overview. Every generator tells AEMO what their price is for supplying electricity using a set of 10 prices and 10 capacities. Price 1 is associated with capacity 1, and so on. This tells AEMO what megawatts is available for what price for every 5-minute period of every day in every region. There are 288 5-minute periods in a 24-hour cycle, and therefore 105,120 5-minute periods in a non-leap year, a few more in a leap year. AEMO then builds a bid stack for each region for every 5-minute period and dispatches generators accordingly, with the highest priced capacity setting the clearing price every 5 minutes. Sorting the capacity by ascending price every 5 minutes is called the merit order, with the cheapest capacity on the bottom and the most expensive capacity on the top. Listeners might take a minute here to Google this phrase, renewables merit order effect. When you do this, you are presented with millions of hits assuring you that low-cost renewables, actually industrial wind and solar, displace more expensive fossil fuel generators, resulting in lower wholesale prices. Now, it may seem incredible to some, but this is misinformation. In reality, the effect of forcing subsidized intermittent generators into the bottom of the merit order is not pushing the most expensive generators out of the top of the merit order. It is removing the middle, the low-cost baseload generators. This is undeniable when looking at the data. In the market system, in every region, the sensible $0 to $100 bids are disappearing, replaced with more capacity offered below zero and more capacity offered above $100. If anybody is asked what a sensible wholesale price should be, the answer should be in the $0 to $100 range as much as possible, and it used to be. Only a few years ago, Angus Taylor, as the Energy Minister, was expressing his wish to get the average quarterly price down to $70 a megawatt hour. That's a good spot because it's some money for generators. If you've got a generator, if you look at AGL's annual report, they will show, it shows you that their cost of owning and operating, including fuel, coal, is about $40 a megawatt hour. They'd be very happy with $70 a megawatt hour. So this is the reality of where we're coming from. I understand there may be some doubts because this is an audio-only podcast and I can't actually show you the data. So let's try a thought experiment instead. What is the aim of energy policy right now? To reduce emissions. But what does that actually mean? What it actually means, in practical reality, is deleting the coal-fired power stations. We all know that. That's 100% true. Energy policy at the moment is targeted at deleting the coal-fired power stations. It's said over and over again. But what does it also mean? Which is also said over and over again, it means to build a lot more industrial wind and solar. It also means to build more batteries, more hydro, and more gas-fired power stations. And that's exactly what's happening. You know, the batteries, everyone knows we're getting more industrial batteries scattered around the grids. Like, some people call them community batteries, but they're not. They're network batteries. Hydro, Snowy Hydro, Kidston here in Queensland. What else? There's Alinta's got a plan to build hydro in New South Wales somewhere. And gas. Well, AGL built a gas-fired power station in Adelaide a couple of years ago, Barker Inlet. They're planning to build another one. We've got Currie, which was the Snowy's Hunter Valley power station, and we've got Tallawarra B. And the Queensland government's planning a couple as well. So the result of that is that we are deleting stable, predictable, boring, reliable baseload generation and replacing it with intermittent, variable, volatile, unpredictable wind and solar, plus expensive batteries, gas, and hydro. Coal is the almost exclusive occupier of the $0 to $100 a megawatt hour wholesale price band. Everything else is outside that. So you can't get a price that settles between $0 and $100 if you don't have anything offering electricity in that price. So the outcome overall is higher wholesale prices. Right, the second problem I call missing money. This is the rooftop solar and home battery side of the system. To visualise this problem, let's consider a domestic electricity consumer who's just taken advantage of Bowen's battery subsidy and invested, let's say, $15,000 in battery and solar. This consumer will pay almost nothing on their electricity bill for at least 10 years. Well, that's the point of it, right? The return on investment. But here's the catch. That $15,000 would have gone into the electricity system over the next decade and contributed to the poles and wires, hundreds of new industrial wind and solar projects, retailer overheads, operations and maintenance costs on existing generators. Instead, it's going to a solar and battery installer who buys his stuff from China. Most of this money is going into the Chinese supply chain instead of our electricity system. The net effect, of course, is anybody who can't afford to opt out of electricity bills get stuck with a higher cost system with a shrinking customer base. The bills have to go up. So that's the disappearing middle, which is your coal, the generator bids, and the missing money, which is opting out of the electricity system altogether with the wind and with the batteries and solar. So this is an intractable problem. Until you get a change of government. And would a change of government even consider changing the scheme? I don't know. I guess we'll find out in the next decade. It's all going to get a lot messier.
The Australian Energy Regulator, whose job it is to keep a cap on things like expenditure on the transmission system, is completely out for lunch. The cost of these transmission projects are blowing out by 100%, 200%, and they just get the cost of these just get waved through. Like it's outrageous. None of these institutions are doing their jobs.
Danny Price not holding back on ABC Radio. Now, what are some of these institutions that we're talking about? Regular listeners will be aware of the AEMC, the AER, and AEMO, the Australian Energy Market Commission, the Australian Energy Regulator, and the Australian Energy Market Operator. We don't hear from their CEOs or the heads of those bureaucracies that often. That would be for AEMO, you've got Daniel Westerman. For the AEMC is Anna Collier, and for the AER, Claire Savage. Here's a quick example of Daniel Westerman.
And we know that the most affordable and reliable energy going into the future is firmed renewables with transmission. To the most affordable and reliable energy. And we know that that is firmed renewables with transmission.
Here's an example of the Australian Energy Market Commission's Anna Collier.
Globally, women and girls are more likely to be disproportionately affected by climate change. And so, again, kind of recognising that that's a difference of experience that we need to be mindful of. We're not, again, reinforcing existing inequality through the impacts of climate change. But also for the energy transition itself, and that there's actually this huge opportunity in this space, and the alignment that I see between trying to achieve our energy transition goals and the goals that we have for gender equity within the participation in the workforce in the energy sector.
Okay, that's a good one. And now here is the head of the Australian Energy Regulator, Claire Savage.
We keep hearing that renewables is the cheapest form of energy, and yet clearly the Ukraine war is putting pressure on prices. When will we see a consequence?
So we already see that. So if you look at December, January, February, when we've got high renewables output, particularly solar through the middle of the day and our wind outputs, we can have negative prices sometimes in the spot market. So we are seeing that positive impact from renewables investment. What we also need investment in, though, is dispatchable forms of capacity. So we need to replace our ageing coal-fired power stations, and we need new gas-fired generation, pumped hydro, storage, batteries, and we also need lots of transmission investment to spread it all around, to transport it around the country.
I think those are three perfect examples of why our energy bureaucracies have lost the plot, or are unable to separate themselves from the green bubble that insulates them from reality. Westerman claims that firmed renewables are cheap. Well, okay, sure, but note how he avoids saying what the effect will be on prices. He knows the total system cost must increase on the current plans, and that means higher bills. He just won't say so. Collier. Climate change affects women more. Jesus Christ. Sure, maybe in Central Africa, where the five wives and 20 children might have to carry a bit extra water, you know, while the patriarch drinks himself to an early grave in a hut on a dirt floor. But not in any Western country. The idea is ridiculous. How are we supposed to take her seriously when she says crazy stuff like this? Savage, on one hand, acknowledges that prices are going up. After all, her department sets the default market offer a de facto retail price cap, then says we must carry on with the transition, but avoids saying that that will cost a few hundred billion to do so. It seems clear to me that Danny Price is correct. The institutions have failed. And who's at the head of all these institutions? The Federal Energy Minister, Chris Bowen. And what does Chris Bowen have to say about things? Here's another extract of something that he might be actually right about for once.
The fact that you need government policy to encourage renewable energy.
Indeed. And this is renewables at any cost. The transition at any cost. There's no concern for the consumers. There's no concern for the environment. It's all about getting as much renewable energy in as possible. And Chris Bowen even said it. He wants it to be so locked in that it can't be changed. This is pretty radical stuff. Danny Price again.
We've got these institutions, but nobody's doing anything. All of the agencies have utterly failed on this, and politically they've failed. It is a mess.
They're politically captured, is what you're telling me. In other words, they've forgotten their core reason for existence, and they've simply become an arm of what, government policy?
Well, they're all motivated to do one thing, and that is to pursue an energy transition at any cost, and it's now become a license to waste enormous amounts of money. And so if you then question it like I am, then you're going to get, there'll be attempts to cancel you from people like the kind of Renew Economy and other places.
The Renew Comedy galas were not happy with Danny Price's report on the nuclear options prior to the election. Here's a sample of that. Sorry, wrong sample. Here it is.
So we saw today, I mean, look, this is so much, I mean, what frustrates me, I mean, I've just looked at this whole policy thing and it makes me so annoyed and so angry because it is so misleading, so mischievous and so effing stupid that it is really beyond belief.
Renew e-comedy. You say it over and over again, you can't say it any other way.
I mean, it's just another... The point is, Frontier had to do that, right? To make nuclear look attractive, they had to, the first thing to do is to make the other side look worse. But no one in the electricity industry thinks it's going to cost anything like that. It's just another standard way of doing things. I'll have to look at his numbers in more detail when I get time.
The last time the integrated system plan was put out by the Australian Energy Market Operator, the total costs of the remaining costs, additional costs of the transition, not including all the potential blowouts, was over $650 billion. You can't spend $650 billion and not have electricity prices or taxes go up.
A fucking goat outside.
It's just a goat.
Chris Bowen is the Minister for Climate Change and Energy. Chris Bowen, welcome to 7:30.
Thanks for asking me on, Sarah.
Now, the Climate Change Authority began its work considering a target for 2030 by asking people to consider a range between 65 and 75. You said today that anything over 70 was unachievable. Can you define unachievable?
Very difficult to pass up an opening like that for the goat. I define unachievable as Chris Bowen's entire policy platform. The GOAT's opportunities here come with Chris Bowen interviewed by Sarah Ferguson on the 7:30 report in the wake of announcing the government's latest emissions reduction targets. These are now 62 to 72% reduction below 2005 levels by 2035. As I was recording this segment, I typed in this question into the usual AI search engine and asked it this question. List Australia's emissions reduction targets with the date and the Prime Minister at the time, and here are the results. In 1997, John Howard said 8% below 1990 levels by 2012. In 2012, Julia Gillard said 5% reduction below 2000 levels by 2020. In 2016, Malcolm Turnbull said 26 to 28% below 2005 levels by 2030. In 2021, Scott Morrison said net zero by 2050. In 2022, Anthony Albanese said 43% reduction below 2005 levels by 2030. And just recently, on the 18th of September 2025, Anthony Albanese has given us 62 to 70% reduction below 2005 levels by 2035. So, with that context done, let's get into the GOAT with Chris Bowen's definition of unachievable.
Well, the Climate Change Authority entered into a lot of consultation with experts and across industry and scientists and recommended to us that we go for the maximum possible level of achievement.
The experts and the scientists. They're to blame, are they, Mr. Bowen?
And we accepted that advice. And they also recommended that the maximum possible level of achievement was 62 to 70% emissions reduction. And that is very ambitious for our country. Let's be clear.
The interviewer, Sarah Ferguson, nodding furiously in agreement.
I've seen commentary out there saying it's not ambitious enough, but let's be clear about what we've accepted today. It is a halving of emissions from today. It's a per capita reduction of emissions of up to 81% from 2005.
It's too early to break out the violins playing the sad song about how beautiful and moral and upstanding and proud we are of our emissions reduction targets, but you can just hear it in his voice. He's just brimming with pride about this.
It's the equivalent of taking the transport emissions out of Australia twice over the next 10 years.
I suggest that transport emissions are going to do sweet F all compared to what they are now. Up till 2030, they're going to be the same or more. And it's just going to cost us a lot more to do it. And why is that? Because you can't stop flying. Well, you can, I guess. They'll just charge a lot more for it. There'll be carbon taxes on the aircraft. You can't stop farming with the diesel. You can't stop mining. You can't stop taking the kids to school. You can't stop the buses or the trains running, or the cruise ships or the ships going in and out. This is crazy stuff.
So This is, as I've often said, it needed to be ambitious and achievable. Mm. The Climate Change Authority, which consists of a very well-respected board, chaired by Matt Keane, also the chief scientist, other people with strong scientific and industry background.
No, no, no. Matt Keane is an activist and basically a teal. He's on the record, on video, on Hansard, saying that the integrated system plan provides the cheapest cost of electricity regardless. He said this in the Senate Environment and Communications Legislation Committee on the 4th of November 2024 at about 20 past 2 in the afternoon. Here's what that sounds like.
So AEMO, and I'm sure you can ask questions to them, Senator.
Pretty sure we can't. They're not here.
on another occasion, but a higher level, they've looked at what the cheapest replacement cost of the existing infrastructure is. So at a high level, they've looked at the alternative solutions to providing cheap, reliable electricity, and they've said that the integrated system plan is the way to do it.
So, but that's what I'm getting to. The constraints are the ISP within the 82%, isn't it?
No, the ISP is a look at the counterfactuals as to other sources of generation to provide the cheapest replacement cost of the existing system.
Miss York, in your inquiry the other day, stated this. No, we're only permitted within the framework whether we set out within the rules to take those policies as set out in the target statement as an input and then work out what is the lowest cost way to get to net zero by 2050.
But, Senator, what the integrated system plan does, it's looked at how we replace the NEM or effectively replace the existing sources of generation that provide electricity to the nation and looked at the cheapest pathway for doing that.
I mean, that's just wrong. It's factually incorrect. Senator Cadell was absolutely right. The integrated system plan is constrained to only look at solutions that meet these emissions reduction targets. That's their definition of the cheapest, whatever they can, within the constraints of those targets. Anyway, here's our great minister at it again.
Recommended this to us as the maximum possible level of ambition, which we have accepted and said we are up for.
I accept all those things about the seriousness of the Climate Change Authority. Did you ask them about a target over 70 and why it couldn't be achieved?
Sarah Ferguson wants more targets. She wants higher emissions reduction targets. She wants to destroy more industries and increase our cost of living for zero impact on the environment.
Well, that's very clear in their report. Mm-hmm. They looked at this very closely, Sarah, as you know. It's a very comprehensive report which runs through the science, the economics and what's achievable.
Can you boil it down?
Yeah, they say in their report, in their advice to me, some people say more than 70 and they say, we do not believe this is achievable without unacceptable economic, social and environmental short-term costs.
I just need to listen to that section again. What did they say again, Mr. Bowen?
And environmental short-term costs.
You have to wonder what the short-term environmental costs are of a greater emissions reduction target. Surely there's no greater urge for humanity than to reduce emissions, regardless of the cost. Who cares about the environment?
Now, if you want, some people might argue that there should be greater environmental, social and economic costs. That's not a view I share.
All evidence points to the contrary. Every single emissions reduction policy increases costs on everything.
This is a target which I think stands up to international scrutiny. It is at the ambitious end of international targets. We're proud of that. That's a good thing.
There's that pride again.
It is a target which is in the economic best interests of the country. So the CSIRO modelling shows that, the Treasury modelling shows that, and it's an ambitious target.
Now, I don't have all those reports in front of me, but I think that is a load of rubbish. There are no reports that tell us that emissions reduction policies are good for the economy.
So will you legislate it? When you legislated the 2030 target, you said it was absolutely essential for business certainty. Isn't that the same this time?
Well, I said it was ideal and preferable at the time because a new government had come in and it was important.
There's no question that you were signalling that it was important for business certainty, whatever the words were you used.
And it would still be ideal.
So will you do that?
Well, Sarah, if I could just answer the question, please. What we will do is our target is there. It does not need to be legislated. It is not a requirement. We will notify the UNFCCC of the new target. It will have force under the Paris Accord.
There's no force possible under the Paris Accord. It's basically a handshake agreement.
If the Parliament shows a willingness to legislate it, the Greens, the Liberals have already said they won't, of course, because they don't believe in climate change.
I beg to differ. I think we'd be much better off if 99% of the Liberal Party did actually not believe in climate change. At least we'd get some sensible energy policy.
But the Greens, if the Greens indicate a willingness to vote for it, then we'll take it to the Parliament. If they're not, then we won't.
That figure that Jacob just used there of 90% renewables, are you going to bring in a new renewable energy target hit 90%?
No, what we're doing...
Sarah Ferguson, again, showing that she just wants more of this stuff. She wants more renewables, she wants more targets, she wants higher costs, because us plebs need to be put in our place so that we can use less energy. We just need to do less stuff. Lock us in our rooms. Good grief.
Continuing with our work to 82% renewables by 2030, which is going well. There are challenges, but also we are making good progress. You know, 1,000 Australians a day are putting in a home battery, for example. Tomorrow, the Prime Minister will mark the 60,000th battery installed.
Indeed. The 60,000th battery installed means 60,000 customers not paying money into the electricity system, which is growing at a large rate. This is the missing money problem, and no one's talking about it. On his point about the there are challenges and it's going well, this week there's a Sydney Morning Herald article with a headline that goes something like this. Not one energy company has committed to fund a new wind farm so far this year. Going well, huh?
And then we've commissioned a post-2030 market review, the Nelson Review, which has already provided an interim report, which has been very warmly and widely received across the sector as the right answer for that 2030 to 2035 period.
This is the Nelson Review that's going to lock in the electricity system entry mechanism, which is just the grand daddy of subsidy schemes beyond 2030. These bureaucrats are out of control.
We're waiting for a final report, but it's pretty clear the direction of travel. And my state and territory ministers and I have agreed that that is a very good direction to follow.
Aren't they just one happy family with no clue about what they're doing and just destroying the country in the process? It's really bad. It's getting really bad now. It's so bad that Chris Bowen was on a Dan Illick podcast, an ex-ABC comic, and this is one of the scariest things I've ever heard anybody announce.
I want this transition to be so locked in that a change of government can't stop it.
All I can say to that is challenge accepted.
So one of the criticisms that I've heard today about what you released today is the absence of details on those parts of the economy that will have to do the very heavy lifting. For example, will you be demanding more from those heavy emitting industries, those industries captured by what's called the safeguard mechanism?
Yes. Yes, he will. And not only is the Climate Change Authority recommending higher emissions targets, the damn Productivity Commission just recently said they're recommending reducing the threshold for the safeguard mechanism from companies that emit 100,000 tonnes a year to companies that emit 25,000 tonnes a year. That will pick up more than 215 businesses. It'll pick up thousands of businesses, maybe tens of thousands. And all of them will suddenly find themselves facing higher arbitrary costs, which means they'll be less likely to spend money on capital, on maintenance, less likely to employ people. They will just be bunkering in, hoping for a change of government.
Sarah, with respect, I don't think that's a fair criticism. We put out, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages of detail today, a new net zero plan, and importantly, six sectors.
There's no specific details on what you're going to look for from the safeguard mechanism, which is an essential part of this heavy lift, isn't it?
There's an industry sector plan written by the industry minister and I, which is quite detailed with due respect. It goes through the decarbonisation pathways for industry, which is what investors asked us for. They said to us as the government, it's important for us to know what you think the decarbonisation pathway is. So that we can invest in the right places. And we listen to that.
That's got to be bollocks. How many companies go to a government and say, tax me more, tax me more? That's absolute bollocks.
Consultatively. And those six sector plans are very detailed and serious documents with new initiatives for the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, the National Reconstruction Fund, electric vehicle charging and, importantly, energy performance and energy efficiency. But to your question, our safeguards reforms, which we legislated early in our term, are working well. They've already delivered in their first year on-site emissions reduction at the facilities, the big industrial facilities, equal to a third of Australia's aviation emissions. That's good progress.
That's good progress if you want to see the end of the country, end of industry, end of... I don't know. I don't know where these people get these ideas from. It's all very bad. Let's see if we can skip forwards a little bit to something more entertaining in this interview.
Can you guarantee now that electricity prices will go down as more renewable energy sources come on?
Stand by for more platitudes and standard talking points.
I can guarantee that renewables are the cheapest form of energy.
That's not the question.
No, but I'm giving you a serious answer, Sarah, with respect, and I'm pointing to the work that's out there from the Australian Energy Market Commission, which showed energy prices coming down 13% if we stick to the plan of more renewables.
Aidan Morrison did a write-up on this on X back in December 2024. The key points that Aidan brought up about the AEMC's modelling is, firstly, they assume the integrated system plan is an objective, credible document. They say that's what it's all based on. We all know that that's rubbish. Another key assumption driving the AEMC modelling is a reduction in wholesale prices in the future under their plan, with more renewables bidding at $0. Now, this goes back to the missing middle problem at the start of the podcast, where I talked about, if you've got a lot of things bidding at zero, you're also going to have a lot of things bidding much higher. You won't have a middle price, therefore you won't set a decent middle price. Everything's going to get more expensive. Now, as renewable penetration increases, curtailment, periods where they all cannibalise each other's market share, just like rooftop solar is doing to everything, and no one will want to buy anything. So, power purchase agreements won't be signed. Enter the capacity investment scheme, which, in summary, if the market won't pay wind and solar PPAs, the government will, or the taxpayer. Meanwhile, the AEMC assumes hydro, gas and batteries will bid just their marginal cost. However, currently Snowy Hydro is bidding about 10 times the price the AEMC assumes and batteries 5 times. So the whole thing becomes just a pointless joke, really. And these modelling activities and these reports and these documents put out by the energy bureaucracies are basically laundering the truth. They rely on flawed assumptions by GenCost and AEMO, and then they turn around and go, oh, we're relying on the experts, here's our modelling, just like everyone else does, but the results are absolutely rubbish. They're laundering the facts.
And the Treasury modelling that you pointed to, showing energy prices will be lower with more renewable energy and higher if we sweat those coal assets for longer, as the Liberal Party is calling for example. So that is what we need to do. The biggest impact that we're facing, both on reliability and cost, is coal-fired power, which is breaking down a lot. We've got big coal-fired power stations out at the moment, for example. That drives up prices. We need to replace that. These coal-fired power stations, they've served Australia well, but they're getting very old.
Help people understand it. How long will that crossover point take before those renewable resources start to drive down prices?
Well, for many Australians, they already are. If you've got solar panels and a battery, as 1,000 Australians a day are doing, you find your energy prices falling dramatically. And that helps also those who haven't done that, because when we get more batteries into the system, it reduces peak demand, which reduces prices for everyone.
There's several points that Chris Bowen's made here. He's mentioned the Treasury modelling, which came out in September 2025. Now, first of all, this modelling only parrots the integrated system plan, which absolutely fabricates many of the assumptions used in its modelling. They're all designed to reach targets and not identify the lowest cost electricity system at all. This is another example of green bureaucracies laundering the facts. He goes on to say that coal is expensive and unreliable, but that whenever there's a coal plant outage, the prices go up. Shouldn't it be the other way around? He states that home batteries reduce prices for everyone by reducing peak demand, but there is no measurable effect of this. And is he talking about wholesale price reductions due to lower peak demand in the evenings? Or is he talking about lower network costs by avoiding network capacity upgrades? By remaining vague and non-specific, he can change the goalposts at any time and deny saying something untrue in the future.
all of us, whether we have a battery or not, prices come down.
And there it is again, the statement that electricity system prices are going to come down for everybody.
But that, you know, that doesn't happen overnight, Sarah.
So how long will it take?
Well, again, we'll have another default market offer out in the next few months. You'll start to see the impacts, but look...
Allow me to quote from the Treasury report, page 40. The projection of lower wholesale electricity prices is attributed to the rapid renewable build-out to achieve the 82% renewable electricity target. As outlined in AEMO's Integrated System Plan, the AEMC anticipates lower wholesale electricity prices will flow through to lower retail prices over time. End quote. I cannot say this often enough. These models are all bullshit.
We've never pretended, in the face of international energy pressures, that all this happens easily or quickly, but we also don't walk away from the fact that renewables are the cheapest form of energy ever known to humankind.
Will this policy rise and fall, succeed or fail on electricity prices?
Well, if you mean in terms of public support, I think that is very important because Australians, I think, do want to see climate action despite the... climate denial of some in politics. The vast majority of Australians do want to see climate action, but they also care about cost of living because it's right before them every day. We have to, as a government, deal with both. And that's exactly what we are doing. And again, the good news is, whilst we do face headwinds and challenges, of course, the fundamental fact is that what's good for your pocket is good for the planet.
If that's true, why does it all cost so much?
And vice versa. Renewables are the cheapest form of energy and the lowest emissions. That is a good thing. It's not a conflict. It means keeping on going with this plan is the right answer for those Australians who very rightly are concerned about cost of living and also those Australians who are very rightly concerned about climate change.
Chris Bowen, thank you very much indeed for joining us, particularly on this day. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Sarah.
Thank you very much.
Mark Ostwald is the convener of Energy Facts and Fiction, a roughly monthly breakfast session where he brings guest speakers in to talk about energy policy and related agendas. Very well received and a lot of good fun. Mark came over to my place a few weeks ago and we had something like a two and a half hour chat. The whole thing's a bit too long for this podcast episode, so I've started it off where I thought it was good. Enjoy.
Okay, so back to AC/DC, not the band. I was wanting to move to a related topic, I think, and that is inertia. And I'm going to reference the Spain-Portugal incident very quickly, but without sort of saying that was inertia, perhaps just from an electrical engineer's perspective, tell us what inertia is again and tell us what role inertia plays in the Australian grid.
Okay. Well, inertia is, it resists change, whether you're talking about it in terms of policy or your children's bathing habits or, you know, your tendency to eat different foods or whatever, inertia, and it's no different in an electricity system, inertia is resistance to change. Now, we're very sensitive to changing frequency because everything, we talked about at the top of the conversation, we talked about the 50 hertz and the motors and all the rest of it. So every single motor, unless it's connected to a variable speed drive, which means it's decoupled from the electricity system directly, if it's a direct online motor, its actual speed is matching that frequency. So if it's a two-pole motor, it's with a bit of slippage, it's sort of running at 2,900 and something RPM. If it's a four-pole motor, it's sort of... nominal 1500s or a bit less because of losses, 1480 something RPM. That's it. So if the frequency goes up a little bit, all those motors speed up a little bit. If the frequency goes down a little bit, all those motors go down a little bit. But also there's effects on the voltage system as well. And because it's all coupled together at the generator source and through the transmission lines, they also have an effect on it. You can't have a system that's sitting there on the brink of falling over all the time, because that's what happened in Spain. Is you get these, they didn't have enough inertia, therefore they had not enough resistance to change, therefore your voltage and frequency started becoming unstable, and very quickly you'll find that if that region there, suddenly the generators over that side of the country speed up and on this side of the grid they're slowing down, if they get outside of a very fine tolerance, the mechanical forces that can be unleashed inside those generators can destroy them. Like this is not a pretend thing, right? You've got millions of horsepower basically,
yep,
pushing through the grid. If you go the other way and you look at cars, you know, 350 kilowatts is 500 horsepower. We're talking hundreds of megawatts here. We're talking millions of horsepower. So you think about those kind of effects being transmitted into the shaft of a generator.
Right.
Can destroy it. So they talk about pole slip and bits and pieces. So any frequency drift is very concerning. Now, frequency is interesting because it's very sensitive and it's almost instantaneous across the network, like those changes.
Yep.
And so that's why it's such an important control signal. So when AMO, Energy Market Operator, sends a set point to a generator and all the generators that it's under control, that it has under its control, it's doing that because of frequency. It's changing the demand or the output of each generator in response to the frequency of the grid. That's the only thing it's doing. The price, that's all separate. That's just all a result of the generators being asked to generate more or less.
So they're being asked to generate more or less depending on the...
To control the frequency. That's it, to keep it at 50 hertz.
So if the frequency is falling by a tiny amount, AEMO is watching that and they can see that in real time and go, we need a bit more here.
Yeah, so when you're talking about inertia...
And that's essentially just more offtakes, more demand coming off the system.
Yeah, you can have... So if everything's perfectly stable and there's no... If the electricity... If the supply and demand are perfectly in balance and there's no real change... You're not calling on inertia because the generators are pushing just enough, the load's pulling just enough, everything's working well. I often think of it in terms of like cruise control in a car, and you're going through like a dead straight road, nice and flat, cruise control in the car, it's not got any demands on it, right? But then you start going up a hill. Then the momentum of the car, the inertia of the car, helps it get up the hill to start with, and then the control system realizes that its speed's dropping slightly, so it starts pushing the engine a bit harder to maintain that speed. It's almost exactly that analogy. So your inertia is not easily measured. It can be calculated for a physical machine, like a spinning machine, but it's at this stage, and I'm pretty sure about this, they can't calculate it for an inverter. Now, if you can't calculate it, how do you predict how it operates?
So just to go back there, and I'm a bit worried about asking this question, but roughly in layman's terms, how would you calculate it?
Oh, the calculations for inertia of a rotating machine can be found in any high school physics textbook.
Right.
So
it's something to do with the weight of the thing that's revolving and the speed at which it's revolving.
Yep, nearly. And there's one other thing. So it's the mass of the spinny thing.
Yep.
It's the angular velocity, how fast it's spinning.
Yep.
And it's the geometry. It's where the mass is.
On the spinning thing. So uh-huh. Closer to the center or closer to the edge.
Correct. And okay. And inertia is such a weird concept that I've got a really good example, but I don't have it set up at the moment. So if you can imagine you have a wooden rod, you're holding it in your hand vertically, and you have a weight on either side of your fist. And you have those weights pushed in close on the other side of your fist, and you start spinning the rod left and right, left and right.
Yep.
Okay. Now, push those weights out to the end of the stick.
Yep.
If when you're trying to come back from flipping the other way, it's going to be a lot harder, isn't it?
It's got more inertia.
It's got more inertia. That's right. It resists the change in direction. So that's it's like gravity. It's always there, but you don't know if you're using it or not. You don't often need it. But what it does, if you have a shock on the system and a shock can be clouds coming over a suburb that's full of rooftop solar.
Yep.
And all of a sudden there's less electricity going into the system. So something needs to provide that electricity, or people need to be using
electricity. So that cloud coming over would cause the frequency to drop?
Slightly, yep. So something else has to push electricity into that system. Now that might not be a large amount to start with. But if that, if nothing catches that frequency and it keeps continuing to drop, that can have, if it starts getting outside the bounds of the capabilities of the generators and stuff to catch it, that's when you start getting things like under-frequency load shedding. You start getting outside those very tight boundaries. And then that adds another shock to the system and another shock. So when you're talking about inertia, it's resisting the rate of change of frequency, the ROCOF. And that's a defined term in the literature. But that you need to make... You're relatively comfortable if your rate of change of frequency is very slow. If it's changing slowly, that's fine. But if it's if that frequency starts changing more rapidly, what you'll find is that that's occurring in a system that has less inertia and less of that gravity that's just always there pushing back, trying to slow that change down. Remember the example of the rod you're flipping around? So as you converting to more and more inverter-based resources, you're basically bringing those weights closer and closer to your fist, and so it's a lot easier to change the direction of that. So you got less and less inertia.
So the angular velocity, was that?
Yeah, how fast it's spinning.
Okay. But so now in our system in Queensland, in the Queensland grid, for instance, where we've got X amount of coal-fired power stations with spinning turbines in every one of them, are those turbines, so they're all spinning at 3,000?
Yep, most of them, unless they're a four-pole machine or something. Hydro generators spin a lot slower because they're physically quite large, but right. they have more poles in them. I'm not sure exactly why, but they do. So hydro machines don't spin at 3,000 RPM. It's probably because of the water going through them. You don't want them spinning that fast with water through them, so they spin a lot slower.
Right, but the coal ones are essentially synchronous, is the word, right? They're spinning.
Yep.
And is their geometry the same? Have they engineered this on purpose so that the weight is toward the outside?
No, they don't design for inertia. It's just inertia is just a result of the
a byproduct. Yeah.
Yeah, it just is, right? So they calculate it, and then that information goes into the model, and that goes to AEMO. And AEMO have documents which stipulate the minimum level of inertia in each region, large substation. So they are, but they only have that information from their calculations. And depending on the configuration on the day, so if you've got in a shoulder month like spring or autumn, when you're not expected to have very high power demand, that's when all your big thermal generators plan shutdowns, right? But they'll tell AEMO, and AEMO will go, yep, okay. And then another one will come along and want to do a shutdown, and AEMO will go, no, sorry, you can't turn off at that point because we won't have enough inertia in the system. You've got to stay on. And they like to have a large buffer.
So you say they're measuring it now. AEMO are concerned about the inertia in the grid now.
Yeah, of course they are, yeah.
But you also said that the turbines weren't designed for inertia.
Well, it's not really the right way to say it. Like they're not designed for inertia. They have a certain amount of inertia based on the how heavy they are, how fast they're spinning, and the geometry.
Was it always a question how much inertia the grid has? Say I'm looking 20, 30 years ago, before we had all the renewables on the grid, or is it only an issue now that the grid has become?
No, the system engineers know. Obviously, they've known that inertia is
a thing.
It's a requirement, but no one's really been too concerned about the minimum amount of inertia available until recently. It's a byproduct. It's always been there. Like I said, it's as soon as you connect a synchronous machine, if it's spinning and connected to the grid, even if it's outputting, if you've got a 1,000 megawatt generator, we don't, but imagine you did. If it's connected to the grid and it's spinning and it's producing 0 megawatts, it's still got all its inertia because it's connected to the grid. That doesn't mean it's so. If the frequency of the grid tried to slow down, well, that big generator is electrically coupled to the grid, so the grid's trying to slow that machine down.
Yep.
So its inertia is pushing back against it. Now you need if you think of all those machines that are actually connected, your Calloids, your Tarongs, your Kogans, your, what are we calling it? Stanwells.
Mill Merrin.
Yeah, all that. All those machines, they add up to sort of thousands of tons.
Yes.
At 3,000 RPM. So when you think about 3,000 RPM, you say it offhand and you're like, no, whatever. Think of it up close, that's a lot. That's pretty fast.
All it's very fast.
Those thousands of tons spinning at that, that's a lot of inertia.
Yep.
So if the grid has a shock on it, like say you get a sudden big storm front that comes across and it needs more energy, and so the frequency is trying to crash and sink, well, all that inertia sort of is there slowing that frequency change down while the measurement systems detect frequency falling and then put more fuel into the feeders, which then goes into the, eventually gets into the boilers, which then fires more steam through the steam turbines and, you know, all this sort of stuff, right? Well, it'll actually happen in reverse to that. So your inertia is just there like gravity, and it's dragging a bit more out of those machines. So it's trying to slow those machines down, but because they're so big and heavy, it's hard to slow them down. And they're not spinning on roller bearings, they're spinning in journal bearings. So they're fun fact, if you take a just a typical steam turbine generator and you trip that unit, shut off the governor valve, and if you just leave it there to spin,
yeah,
it might spin for a couple of days.
Yeah, right.
There's special bearings, right? It's good stuff in microns thick. So this is good gear.
And the gear oil in there is doing all the work.
Yeah, you got jacking oil pumps and all that kind of stuff. What in your journal bearings? So it's an interesting technology that it looks very, very basic, but it's actually extremely fit for purpose. Anyway, so very little friction, and those generators will spin for days if you let them. That's why you take the vacuum off them, and there's a bunch of techniques in there. But when you're all that inertia, all that spinning mass, is electrically coupled to the grid. The grid frequency starts dropping because of some disturbance out there, whether it's a bunch of solar things have gone off because of a cloud or a big drag line started up and it's pulling more out. The first thing that happens is those machines will tend to try and slow down, but the inertia is saying, not so fast.
Yeah.
I'm gonna keep rolling. Then as your speed of the machines, because in the power station, obviously they're looking at frequency, but they're actually a much more accurate measurement is the speed of the turbine itself. So they'll have their set point and it'll be measuring the speed based on the shaft speed, which is that's the prime measurement. So you talk about your primary frequency control, it's actually looking at the speed of that shaft.
Yep.
So if that speed starts dropping, then it'll detect that within a few spins, and then the control system will go, oh, that's a bit off target, so I need to open the governor valve a bit, put a bit more steam through the steam turbine, push a bit harder against that resistance, which is the grid trying to slow it down. And then
so the regulator,
that'll drag some pressure out of the boiler.
Right.
The control system will say, I need more steam pressure, so it'll feed more coal into the boiler,
right,
and it'll eventually catch up, right?
Okay, that's cool. So
the inertia gives that time for the rest of the control systems and that infrastructure to catch up. Inertia itself is not really an energy source. It's just a shock absorber.
Yep. It allows a little flexibility so that other things can be...
It slows more. It all down.
Yep. So the system with increasing... contribution from renewables, wind and solar generators, has less inertia.
Which is what Spain went through recently, right?
Right. So what is Spain doing, or what has Spain done, or what has Spain not done that has not compensated for this reducing quantity of inertia in the system?
Well, yeah, it's hard to tell from here. Obviously, they had a lot of solar and wind on the system. From what I've read so far, I believe there was a shock, an electrical disturbance. So something slowed down or something tripped off, something along those lines, and that created that electrical disturbance in either the voltage or the frequency. Something then, without the inertia to damp that down and slow that down naturally, various, if you have a control system and it says the voltage is falling or the frequency is falling, I need to then react and do something, change my output of my generator to catch it. So from the, if you take it in terms of timestamps, it takes a certain amount of time to detect a problem, a certain amount of time after that to, for the PLCs or the computer systems to decide what to do about it, make a decision,
yep.
And then a certain amount of time for the thing on the output side to actually act.
Yep.
Now, if that time frame from knowing there's a, knowing you need an action or measuring a disturbance to taking action to counteract that disturbance, if that time is greater than the disturbance is reacting itself, you got no hope. You don't know what's going on. So, for example, think about if you're traveling along a flat road in your car,
yep.
And it's on autopilot.
Cruise control.
Cruise control, that's the right term, thank you. And or even maybe the have you got lane detection on your car?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hate it.
I do too. Anyway. I don't like it when it grabs a wheel. That annoys me. But so lane detection. So cruise along a perfectly straight road, the car might drift slowly and it sees it, it can correct that. It doesn't care. It mm-hmm. can handle that.
Mm-hmm.
You're cruising along a straight road and you get a strong gust of wind mm-hmm. and pushes the car over, it, mm-hmm. it can handle that. What if you're it got a strong gust of wind which pushed it over there, but then that gust disappeared
yep.
and that car's correcting, trying to go back, it's going to overcorrect in yep. that sense, right? So, and if you're getting different gusts of winds at speeds that the car can't really recognize and react to, it doesn't know what's, it's trying to react to something that it can't control.
Yep.
The inertia slows everything down within the bounds of your control system so that you've got a really good chance of correcting it, right? Depending on the size of the disturbance. But when you don't have enough inertia, it can very quickly get beyond the bounds of your control system to do anything about it. So if you're, for example, with your car, and if you then have a bend in the road, and it's going, oh, I've got a bend in the road. Then it gets a gust of wind that hits it as well. Yep. And it's like, hang on a second, I've got to correct the other way. You can imagine very quickly that your car's trying to veer right, but the road's going left, and you can have a catastrophic situation. That's basically what's happened in Spain. You had frequency and voltage getting a bit of a disturbance, and then the system couldn't measure it, decide, and respond.
Fast enough.
And eventually it got out of whack and fell over.
So it fell over. And from what I hear, the connector to France, to the nuclear, it tripped because it saw the magnitude of the problem and it didn't want to follow it down the same path.
I'm not sure how they had their interconnected controls over there. With stuff between different countries, they might have some rate of change of stuff on them. If they see something wild going on outside the bounds, there might be some contractual stuff, which is not so much related to the physics or the stability of it.
Yep.
But they just might go, hang on, you're out of spec. It's like maybe sending water to somebody and they go, hang on, nah, that's out of spec. We're not taking that anymore.
And so that's just a big switch that disconnects.
Oh, yeah, just a circuit breaker, yeah.
Okay, so we'll bring it back home to Australia then.
But in that sense, there might also have been a case where the they hit thermal limits. So if your power's swinging around a lot and that interconnector is rated at a certain amount of megawatts, it's rated that way because at the top of the conversation we're talking about amps
yep.
and heat and conductor size,
yep.
thermal limits on your conductors or through your substation, through your transformers.
You're going to burn something, it'll blow something up.
Correct. So if they were hitting some kind of limits around there, that might have taken out the interconnector as well.
So is that literally a temperature sensor on something that's picked up a rising temperature or conceivably picking up a rising
temperature? They've definitely got temperature sensors in transformers.
Right.
And in some other conductors as well. But generally it'll just be based on a megawatt rating.
Okay, so...
And also, if they see that megawatt rating is ramped down, and if they see it coming up really fast, it'll act on that as well so they don't overshoot.
Okay, so back home here in Australia, the southern states seem to be a little bit more exposed to this declining inertia versus Queensland. Do we have a similar switch at the border that will protect, will protect us in...
We're connected to New South Wales via the QNI, Queensland, yep. New South Wales interconnector. There was an upgrade project on that a couple of years ago. I think it's up to around about 1,500 megawatts now. There's a small DC link down at Terranora, I believe, which is nowhere near as large. DC is an interesting one. DC interconnectors, which are like your undersea cables. Yep. So basically there's at each end of that undersea cable, yep. or at each end of the DC link connector, the cables are DC. It's not AC power that's transferred.
Yeah, I think you told me this the other day. Why do we have DC underwater again?
I think the cables are cheaper. Once you get to, you could do it either way, to be honest. But at some point there's a crossover where it's cheaper to turn it into DC at the start of the cable, use DC cables and turn it back into AC at the other end, which is big inverters and rectifiers, right? And so at some point it's cheaper to have all that than have just an insulated AC cable.
Okay.
So in that sense, if you're looking at something like that's hundreds of kilometers long and, you know, thousands of megawatts, the AC cable will be super expensive at that point to insulate and put underground.
Okay, but back to state of origin. Is there a switch at the border, and or should there be a switch at the border in light of the changing?
Well, there's definitely a substation down there close to the border where that Queensland, New South Wales interconnector lives. I haven't looked that up. I should figure out where that one is. But yeah, you could definitely open that, and it has opened occasionally in the past. A couple of years ago, you had a situation where the Queensland QNI tripped, and I think I think South Australia's interconnector tripped at the same time, like within a couple of hours of each other, and that was due to lightning.
Yep.
So Queensland was islanded from New South Wales and the rest of the NEM, and it does happen occasionally, and there's planned maintenance activities which are necessary sometimes, which will do that. But yeah, it is. Yeah, there's if you've got electricity, you've got switches. So yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So changing gear a little bit. We've obviously been conversing on this topic for some time now. You posted a graph some weeks ago, maybe even months now, that stuck with me, and you'll know the one I'm talking about. It's the graph that charts over time the NEM capacity, the NEM demand, and the NEM average wholesale price. Mm. And I was somewhat shocked to learn from the graph that you posted that our NEM capacity has maybe doubled over the last 20 years. Mm. And while our NEM demand has barely risen at all, if at all, our demand today for the NEM is essentially what it was in 1999 or 2000. But while our capacity is almost doubled, our demand has stayed roughly the same, the prices spiked enormously. Mm. So this is what I'm sort of calling the capacity correlation. And it's actually a negative correlation, isn't it? Because it's opposite to what you would expect. Mm. We've got all this extra capacity. Where's all the generation going? It's inconceivable that we've spent all this money to build capacity for our electricity grid that plainly isn't all being used.
Yeah, well, this is the lovely situation we find ourselves in with all this intermittent generation. So when you consider the point of the chart, I'm glad you noticed it actually, because it seems to me like the fundamental story. It's pretty close to the base of the problem. So yeah, I looked at the Australian Energy Regulator's website. They've got a really good website, which is Wholesale Market Statistics, and it shows all sorts of stuff. One of them is installed capacity of the national electricity market every year since, you know, 1998, whatever it is. since the whole market became interconnected. And it does show, so in the blue, it's a column chart, so the blue vertical columns, they cruise along for a few years, not much change, and then they start getting a lot longer, a lot taller. And that's the increase in capacity, even though we're turning off coal-fired power stations, right, in the same time. So that increase in capacity, apart from the odd small sort of gas-fired power station, has been large-scale wind and solar. And on that chart, I exclude rooftop solar. Rooftop solar is another 16 gigawatts or something. So we've gone from 30-something gigawatts to nearly 60-something gigawatts.
Yep.
You're right. So it's nearly a doubling in
And how much rooftop capacity. Solar?
Another 16 on top.
So that's 70-plus gigawatts for
Indeed.
A demand which is, what, 30-something?
Peaks out at 30, 35 maybe on a really hot summer. So that's the installed capacity. And you're right, the demand line is interesting as well, because when you think about what's happened with our electricity system, you'd think we've got more people. Why do we not have increasing electricity demand?
Much more people.
So part of that is the rooftop solar. Rooftop solar takes the daytime. We used to have midday daytime peaks. Now we've got a slightly lower sort of 6 p.m., 8 p.m. peak.
Yep.
People getting home from work. The stove goes on, the hot water systems go on.
So you said we used to have a daytime peak, now we have an evening peak.
Yes. Yeah, the effect of all the rooftop solar has been to take the top off that daytime peak where industry is maxing out and all the air conditioners and the offices and all the rest of it, and shuffle that to when, you know, people get home from work, when the solar goes away.
Does that imply we've had an industrial reduction?
Oh, I think we definitely have. We don't make cars anymore.
Yeah.
We won't make aluminium for much longer.
So electricity...
Data centres are questionable.
electricity consumption is a proxy for economic
activity. The other thing we've had with over that time is we've also gone from, lighting was generally incandescent bulbs.
Yep.
Then we went to CFLs, compact fluorescence. Now we're into LEDs. So we're sitting here in my place. All my downlights are all LEDs. I could run them all day and all night and you wouldn't even be able to measure the power out of them, basically. Right,
okay.
So that's part of it. Switch mode power supplies. So if you look at your TV, so my TV hanging on the wall over there, they used to have transformers in them and pull in AC power. Now they don't. Now they've got a thing called a switch mode power supply, which is kind of like a inverter in reverse.
Right.
And it all runs on DC internally, just like your laptop. But those switch mode power supplies are super efficient and very low waste, and they can be and they're cheap to make as well. So there's been efficiency. So again, in motors, fridges and air conditioners, we've got smarter controls, we've got more efficient motors, we've got better tolerances, better materials, we've got better gases in fridges and better insulation, all that kind of stuff, right? So we've got a lot of variable speed drives. So in terms of industry, you've got less sort of losses in the electricity system as well. So all that stuff is happening sort of at the same time. But yeah, so when you look at the in aggregate,
yep,
total electricity demand on our grid is not more than it was 20 years ago, right?
Not really.
Flat or slightly less.
Yeah.
Now, that's kind of incredible, right? So at the same time, we're installing a shitload more wind and solar
capacity.
Yep.
In inverted commas.
Now, the problem is that you would expect that if you've got a flat demand and more supply, your price should get lower.
Absolutely.
It's not.
Definitely
not. And there's a really good reason for that. Well, there's a couple of reasons. One is gas prices. Gas prices will push the wholesale price around more than anything else.
Yep.
And hydro's in there as well, and batteries. But the other reason is that we're swapping dispatchable capacity for intermittent capacity. And when it's dispatchable, you don't need as much of it because you can turn it on and you know it's going to turn on. With intermittent, you just got to build it and hope, and then don't turn the other stuff off as well. So we're not replacing capacity, we're installing additional capacity. And this is what I think is the fundamental problem in our, probably all the way up to the policies. Don't get me started on net zero.
Yeah, well, I won't.
And
I'll leave that for another day. That's great, Ben. I think I just have one more question for you, and it might be the stupidest question of the day, but they say the only stupid question is the one you don't ask. So during the middle of the day, particularly in Queensland, we get a lot of sunshine. We produce a lot of solar generation, both from our rooftop solar and from the industrial solar generators. I understand the price goes negative on any given sunny day between sort of 10 and 2, implying that there's more solar generated than's required, or at least there's more generation on the entire grid than is required. Are we, so in my simple mind, there's, it's like you've got a pipe of, and it's hosing out water everywhere. You've filled up the tank, let's say, and it's overflowing. The water's going on the ground. In the case of electricity, where does the electricity go?
Okay, so it's, yeah, it's we're not generating more than we can use. We're not wasting any. It's basically every bit of electricity that you generate has to be consumed, including in storage. So you don't let it spill on the ground. That'd be bad. There'd be fires and dead people everywhere, right? But the negative price is related to an oversupply situation.
Yep.
So and that's primarily caused by rooftop solar. We've got a lot of rooftop solar, 4 million homes or roofs.
Which we can't control.
Yeah, and yeah, 99% of it is uncontrollable. It'll be on when it's on and it'll be off when it's off. So what that actually does is that rooftop solar is all at sort of these low voltage distribution level. You'll call it behind the meter because it's not measured anywhere except inside the people's homes and their devices. But the situation is, from the terms of a grid generator, if a lot of the load in the houses is being supplied by the rooftop solar, you're drawing a lot less from the grid. That means the demand for the grid generators has to go down because they've got to AMO, we talked about it, has to balance the frequency.
Yep.
So if you take the rooftop solar supply and you just it's lost market share. So the market
for everybody else.
The market share for generation is shrinking in the day. What that does is it pushes the generators all bid in bands up to and every generator's got 10 bands and they've got a certain amount of megawatts in each band and each band has its own price as well. I can show you the details of that later. Doesn't come across well in an audio-only interview. Yep. But the market operator then stacks these bids. And it starts with the cheapest bid, which will be a bunch of wind and solar, but also coal-fired power stations offer a lot of their capacity at the market floor because they don't want to be turned off in the day. So they'll just offer it for negative, nothing. They'll try and outbid.
Because they'd just rather keep rolling.
To the bottom end, right? It's a race to the bottom to try and stay online. So they're all trying to stay online during the day. So they'll just give it away. Now, or in the bids anyway. And the market operator will take the cheapest bids in each region and build up those megawatts until they every 5 minutes until they have enough to meet the supply. The generator at the top of that stack, the most expensive one, is what sets the price.
Yep.
So in the terms of that bid stack, sometimes that bid stack doesn't get out of negative.
Yep.
During the day, right? So that's why you get negative prices because there's... They either don't need a certain amount of generation or on all the generation they do need, even though they're stacking in from the cheapest to the most expensive generator is still negative because they haven't gone into those other bands, those other price bands yet because there's not enough load out there to ask for more generation.
Okay, so in the event that there's more generation coming on than is required... Somebody's turning off. If the rooftop solar, it's coming on regardless.
Well, the generators are all backing out.
Yeah.
And what you'll find is that the coal-fired generators, especially in New South Wales, that you see this quite often, they have a technical turndown limit that you can't turn a 600 megawatt coal-fired power station down below about 200 megawatts.
Yep.
Maybe a little bit more. So if it's 600 megawatt boiler, and these are technical limits based on how much fuel you can throw into the pulverized fuel you can throw into the boiler, right? Before you've got to then start putting diesel or oil into it
as a firing support. Otherwise, think about it.
Okay.
Because when you do your barbecue,
yeah,
and you got your gas flame, do you turn it off at the bottle?
Yep.
Yep. And you hear a little
yep
at the end. Imagine that, but in, you know, 8 stories high.
Ooh.
Yeah, not good. So if your flame goes out, you've got a whole bunch of hot fuel in there, in this boiler, which for a 600 megawatt power station could be 10 stories high, right?
Right.
In this one boiler.
Right.
There, it's a big machine. If that goes off in an uncontrolled manner, you the whole thing
it,
will
You mean if it kind destroyed. Of reignites?
Well, if it goes off... Like if it's a fireball, right? So you're inside your if for those people lucky enough to have seen the inside of a boiler, they've got windows in certain places. You can see the fireball.
Yep,
it's an amazing thing. Love it. That fireball is very well controlled by where you direct the air into it, where you throw the fuel into it. You're controlling your oxygen content, and you're controlling where that fireball is vertically,
huh,
and how it's operating. Like There's not that many people around who can actually visualize it and adjust the dampers and all the rest of it to control it. And then they're well reimbursed, those guys.
Yeah, let's do a baseload tour. Let's put a bus together and we'll go up to Tarong.
I know a couple of them. They're good guys. But there's an Olympics connection there as well, I'll tell you one day. But this fireball, it's only self-sustaining at a certain firing rate. So you can only if you stop putting the right amount of fuel into it, like it won't actually combust. It'll fall in a heap. So you've got to keep it alight. Yep. And if you go down too far,
it's your fuel air mix. Same as in your combustion engine.
An air fuel ratio. Yep. It's related to that stoichiometry, all that good stuff. But if you drop that fuel down too far, because you don't need the steam.
Yep.
Right. Because you don't need the megawatts, because the rooftop solar.
Yep.
If you drop down too far and that goes out, it's still hot.
Yes.
And there's still fuel in there.
Uh-huh.
Not a good situation. That can go bang.
Because right? It's really hot.
Yeah, it's really hot. Yeah, hundreds of degrees. Yeah. It's cold. It's burning. So it's a fireball.
As soon as it gets a bit more air, it will spontaneously combust.
It could catch fire and explode. So this is why the minimum rundown of the coal-fired power stations, there's a nice fat safety margin in there before they turn off that last coal feeder. Because they go, oh, actually, all we're down at the minimum turn down. That's it. So what they'll do, and you'll see it in New South Wales, you can see it on the visualizations. If you look at the individual coal units and you see what happens in the day, they'll be up at night, and then they'll come down during the day, and then they'll flat output. That's their minimum. That's their minimum turn down. And they won't go below that. Now the problem for the system is that we'll get more and more solar. The politicians love the rooftop solar.
Yep.
That daytime minimum, you still need less and less electricity. Now, the only things that can turn down then is the wind and solar farms are now getting curtailed,
uh-huh,
because there's nowhere to put the electricity. So they...
Right. Now we're getting to the point.
The wind turbines can feather their blades, and the solar farms are nearly always single-axis tracking, so they can turn away from the sun.
Okay.
And they quite often get told to, more and more, because...
Because you can't let the coal generators turn down any further because they'll... Yeah.
So
it's A, dangerous, but then B, if you turn them all the way down, they won't be there for the nighttime when, you know, a few hours later when the sun goes down.
Those operational requirements are all part of it. Now, back to the inertia conversation we were having earlier, and I mentioned the minimum synchronous limits that AMO has charts for these and different configurations.
Yep.
Well, they will also say, well, no, you can't turn off. If a coal-fired power station says, oh, I'm going to turn off for the winter.
Uh-huh.
It's costing me too much money. I'm never getting above minimum load. At some point, AMO are going to go, no, sorry, you've got to stay on. And then that generator will go, okay, well, here's my bill.
Well, they've already done that, haven't they, in some cases?
In some cases,
So they're going to have to pay these coal generators to stay open at some point.
Yeah, that's the extension of this conversation, right, what happens next. But during the day, in areas where there's an oversupply of wind and solar and rooftop solar, they're the ones that start getting turned off. And you can't turn off the rooftop solar. We already talked about that because AMO, no one can reach into those inverters and say, stop generating.
So going back to your graph with all your blue lines, all that additional capacity that we paid to install, now we're going to have to start turning it off.
Yeah, and it's going to get worse as well. So if we're talking about the future, we're talking about we've already got this oversupply of wind and solar and rooftop solar. Every policy is continuing to install rooftop solar, and every state, that's in the states, and the feds are now going to come in with their capacity investment scheme, Chris Bowen's capacity investment scheme. Now, what that does, the way I understand it, and I'm happy to be corrected, but the way I understand it is that it's not paying generators based on dollars per megawatt hour. It's not paying them for output. It's just paying them on revenue.
To exist.
Yes. So they will, if I'm right about this, and I think I am, they'll basically be a wind farm developer will come along and they'll do their, go through the auction process, whatever, give them a floor price and a ceiling price. And outside those, if it's below that, if they earn below that revenue in a month, then the government will top them up to that line. If they earn above that, if they earn below the low limit, they'll get a top up from the taxpayer.
Yep.
If they earn it above the high limit, they have to give some back. Now you tell me how many in the situation where the all the wind turbines and all the solar farms and all the rooftop solar are on at the same time, we're already talking about negative prices during the day. If you get even more and more of that stuff, they're only going to be generating at the same time. So they're only going to be generating in negative prices. So they're always going to be topped up.
If the government's topping up and...
the taxpayer's topping up.
Great point. Calling in this manner across the market, in inverted commas, it's not really a market anymore, is it? It's just...
It hasn't been a proper market for years now. The renewable energy target pretty much took care of that. I mean, it was 2% when John Howard brought it in back in, 2002. So the national electricity market had been all of, 2 or 3 years old by then. And then it got distorted by a renewable energy target, which made no difference for a couple of years. But then as China started getting involved and the price of the equipment started coming down dramatically, the states and everyone started getting involved. So we've got a lot more of it. And every single megawatt is subsidised. And it's, there's only a certain few things that the government can do or the country can do going forwards. I expect... And we're already seeing some of that, right? So Eraring, Loy Yang A, Yallourn, they've all got a lifeline. Yeah, Eraring and Yallourn are meant to turn off in 2028. Good luck with that.
Which is just...
In the same year.
And that's just a case of physics winning the battle.
There's a physics, a whole physics question, yeah. And the economics side of it is that no private entity is going to build a baseload power station.
In the current environment.
Not because of the market share problem. Mm. You need... A capital-intensive baseload power station, like a coal or a nuclear, for example, could make heaps of money at sort of under $100 a megawatt hour, right? They would do that easily. And if you're sort of government-backed maybe and you've got 30 years investment time frame, that money will come in. And after that sort of 25, 30 years, it's all positive, right?
Yep.
But that's a long time in this day and age for any private investor to consider that. But to do that at those low prices, you need market share. You need a lot of output.
You need to be running 90% of the time.
You need high capacity factor, right? But with the amount of subsidized intermittent generation on the market and the rooftop solar, and none of it's going anywhere, that market share is shrinking every day. Mm. And it's going to get worse with the other schemes and all the rest of it, like the capacity investment scheme we talked about. So they need the synchronous generators for the physics,
yep,
the inertia, something that can turn on and off. Some people think it's going to be batteries. It's not. That's just not going to happen. So that I expect there's going to have to be some kind of intervention, a bit like Eraring and Loy Yang and Yallourn, where whether it's a state or the feds, they're going to have to go into some kind of caretaker period. And I expect, because you can't force a private company like Alinta or AGL to operate an asset at a loss. No. You just can't do that. But what they can do, and they can't tell it to turn it off. They can't allow it to turn off either. So what they have at the moment is a three-year flag, Eraring, Frank Calabri did that quite well with Eraring a few years ago. He said, 2025, we're going off. And that was in 2022. And so now it's like, okay, well, it's 2020. Yeah. So it's not going to happen, right? So what I expect is they'll still have to put their hand up and say, we don't want this asset anymore. We're closing it. But the government will go, no, I think we're going to have to keep that on for a bit longer. And then they'll enter into a handshake deal or some kind of secret deal, which will be a caretaker period. So I think what that'll be, something like, say it's a coal-fired power station, say a Raring. Say the 2028 comes along and Origin goes, no, we're definitely closing it. We've had all your notices. We're off. We're shutting it down. In 6 months' time, it'll be offline forever.
Yep.
The state government, the Fed government go, okay, fine. What are we going to do? How are we going to keep this thing online at least for another year or another 2 years?
Buy it for a dollar.
What they could offer to buy it, or they could offer to go, all right, well, tell you what, you have like an open book policy with us on the costs. We'll give you 5 to 8% return.
Cost plus.
But you've got to keep it available and maintained.
Yeah.
Because some days there won't be any wind.
Well,
and there won't be any sun, and it doesn't look good if you've got to turn the shops off and the freezers off and the people can't watch Neighbours at night time.
Hello, Spain. Well, you know, it's proving one thing, and that is that despite the fact that all of these generators have been privatised all those years ago, they are still public utilities, and the state government still has ultimate responsibility to the citizens for electricity. Whether they pretend it's a market or not, ultimately they own the problem.
Well, privatisation, yeah, I think there's a really adult discussion has to happen about that, and the role of governments, whether you've got to do public-private partnerships, things like that, I don't know, but yeah, just pure privatisation for something that's this critical, I don't think it's going to work, and I don't think it's going to be a model that goes ahead.
Well, Ben, I think I've run out of questions for today. Thanks for having me on to interview you.
Thanks, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Baseload Podcast. If you like the show, subscribe and tell your friends. Remember, the mailbox is open, thebaseloadpodcast@gmail.com.